Ireland is getting older. That presents a unique set of challenges that we, as a nation, as a population, are going to have to rise to. I'm Peter Kavanagh, and this is The Old Country, a podcast about ageing in Ireland brought to you by Active Retirement Ireland, in association with the Community Foundation, as part of the UN Decade of Healthy Ageing. Hello and welcome to The Old Country, a podcast about ageing in Ireland to celebrate the decade of healthy ageing. I'm Peter Kavanagh and I'm joined in studio today by an adjunct lecturer with the Irish Centre for Social Gerontology in NUI Galway, who is an independent consultant on ageing and policy and advocacy, a former head of global ageing advocacy and campaigns for Help Age International, and I suppose it's fair to say in another life, quite a while ago now at this stage, a former National Director of Older and Bolder. Patricia Conboy, thanks a million for coming in to speak to us today.
It's wonderful to be here, Peter, and thanks for inviting me.
No, it's a pleasure. And obviously with a CV like that, you've been working in the ageing sector for quite some time, and we were delighted to have the opportunity to bring you on because this podcast is to mark the beginning of the UN Decade of Healthy Ageing. And I suppose if we could put to you the big question, why do we need a decade of healthy ageing?
Well, the Decade of Healthy Ageing is an initiative to focus on healthy ageing and involve everyone, not just older people, in a discussion about ageing and what we need to do to promote well-being over the life course and as people get older. So we know the structure of populations is changing. That means our societal systems need to change as well, the way we organise ourselves. And the great advantage of a UN-led decade is it gets all of the international players on board at a UN level and an institutional level, at the global level, if you like. But it also offers the opportunity for action at regional, at national and at community levels. And there's really scope for everybody to get involved. Some of the, there are four core actions. Mm-hmm. Two of them are the traditional health focused actions, if you like, but two are not. The two that are not health focused specifically are about age friendly and enabling environments for all of us as we age, and about really highlighting and unpicking and revealing and tackling ageism. And that's the part that I find really exciting because it underpins so much of the discrimination that older people experience.
I think to just pick out two things that you said there, because I do think it's fascinating, this idea that we're finally turning to ageism, to highlight it, to say that it's there, it's pervasive, it's everywhere. There's structural ageism, there's informal ageism, there's all different sorts of ways that older people are treated in ways or kept out from activities or things that are insidious in a way. And the other thing is that it's about getting everybody involved. So, I mean, just to sort of take those two things, there is an old adage in social gerontology that if you start planning for ageing when you're 55 or 65, you're doing it decades too late. So are we taking the right tack by trying to let absolutely everybody know that ageism is there, and maybe we could examine our own behaviours and maybe we could have a look at how we have been or are ageist in maybe conscious or unconscious ways and to address that and to do better?
I think we are, in the sense that there is now in Ireland a lot of discussion amongst people involved in the world of ageing about equality and the need to bring an equality lens to how our society is organised for people of all ages. And I think that ageist, or that discussion about ageism, can really make a very important contribution to the unpicking of how inequality works, and particularly how it works against older people. Your point about, you know, really starting earlier, I think if the pandemic has shown us anything, it is that there is inequality across society. Mm-hmm. The last thing we need is generations pitched against each other in terms of a scramble for resources. If we actually think in terms of healthy aging as being something that everybody has a stake in, that we need good public services for people at all stages. So education when we're younger and older, transport younger and older, health younger and older, all of those, I think we can see a way in which we can, in solidarity, which would be very much in keeping with how we've done things in Ireland during the pandemic, I think, actually work together to make Ireland a better country in which to grow old.
Yeah, I'm thinking back now to when President Higgins was on the campaign trail for his first election, One statement he said really resonated with me. He said, I've met with thousands of people on the campaign trail, and not one younger person has ever asked for anything at the expense of an older person. And not one older person has ever asked for anything at the expense of a younger person. So it seems in many ways that realistically, when you speak to people, it's not a real argument, generations pitted against each other for resources. It's something that we see in the media. It's created, it's crafted.
Well, what I would say there is, I think you probably hear more of that depending on the national context. Mm. So, as you know, I've been living in England. I would have heard more of that kind of discussion in England. And I would agree it was to some extent crafted. I think there is more of that kind of discussion in the States as well. It's much less prevalent in public discourse here. Mm. And I think that one of the things that would concern me about it is that it takes our eye away from inequality within cohorts and within generations. So inequality builds up over the life course. This is what we know. Mm. And that's why healthy aging, well-being in older life, we begin to build towards that really from the day we're born, the kind of families we're fortunate or unfortunate enough to be in, etc. So there's a lot of promise. Now, I'm also going to say with any UN decade, we know that we can have the razzmatazz, yeah, and we can have the labels and we can have, you know, the social media activity and so on. But at the end of the day, it's going to be down to groups of people. I hope age organisations, but other, you know, working in collaboration with others, you know, intersectionally, in different sectors, governments, but also groups of older people themselves to actually, and young people, to actually, you know, say, look at what will we do? Because it's structured so that people organise their own activities. So they're resourced in terms of toolkits and information, etc. But how it will shape up at this stage, you know, and it's early stages yet, it's the first year, it's quite loose. There's very much a focus on raising awareness, letting people know this is happening. And me coming from where I'm coming from, I say, OK, really make this about ageism, because I think that's so important.
I think it's crucial, and one thing that you said there is like that intersectionality. I think that's crucial, because we have discussed on the podcast before the concept of cumulative disadvantage, that if you are discriminated against throughout your life, then it's only going to exacerbate or get worse when you're older, because it's compounded by the fact that you may be subject to ageist or discrimination or ageist behaviour then at that case. So that's on top of being a woman or being a person of colour or being LGBTQI+ or being a migrant or a traveller. The list goes on and on to add ageism on top of that. So I suppose that's why it's crucial that the work to tackle that has to be intersectional and has to reach across all different sort of strata of society.
Absolutely. And I will say, I mean, at a global level, it was one of the things that sometimes disappointed me, that I would actually see, if you like, interest groups working in their sectors. So I'd, you know, might be working in relation to gender, working in relation to disability, working in relation to whatever our particular issue was, and not necessarily taking the life course approach. And I think that's the great benefit of the life course approach. It allows us, you know, to come together to address our own issue, to see exactly, as you've said, you know, the cumulative issues at end of life, and, you know, to really think about, I mean, the slogan at the moment is build back better, build back greener and so on. And I hope we will. But actually, what would that mean in practice? I suppose the other thing I'd like just though to say, Peter, is, yes, we need to take the life course approach. And, you know, this is for the decade is for everybody. I think that part of the ageism we have in our society is we do tend to think, I know you've spoken in other podcasts with about, you know, homogenizing older people, 65 plus, but we do tend to think life stops at 65 in the sense that now you're going to go, you're going to rest, you're going to have trips and you're going to have holidays and that's what you're going to do. Well, I'm now an older woman. I've no intention of living my life like that. So I suppose what I'm saying is that there's also a need for us to actually look at you know, the lifespan from 60 or 65 on and say, well, you know, there's potential there. There are stages there, in the same way that we think about, you know, early life, people going through different stages. And there are all kinds of pathways and opportunities in society to facilitate that. So I think there's potentially exciting work to be done there as well.
I think that's a brilliant point, because we look at early childhood, and we look at preschool, we look at primary school, we look at secondary school, and into if you're privileged and lucky enough, you go on to college or you're going into a job, and we would easily differentiate between those ages and say there's a world of difference between a 19-year-old starting first year of college and a 15-year-old doing their junior cert or a 12-year-old finishing primary school. And that's a 20-year time frame. And yet we look at this 40-plus year time frame of retirement until death, whenever that might be. And that endpoint is getting longer and longer and further away. We're living longer. We're hopefully living healthier lives. And yet we're still very quick to homogenize that group of people and say older people's issues, and lump it all into one. And in the context of Ireland, and you're no stranger to this, you're very familiar with this, in the context of Ireland, is to lump it all into one office in the Department of Health and look at it entirely through that lens.
Yes, yes. And what I would say, just because I've been in England and now I'm trying to refamiliarise myself with the detail of how things are in Ireland at the moment, there's a lot that's interesting that's happening in terms of the policy world and for older people. So at the moment, if you think, there's a consultation on the review of the equality legislation. Mm. There's a promise for a care commission. There's, you know, the pensions and welfare report has been produced. You know, there is the Universal Periodic Review reporting in on Ireland's human rights record in November. So there's an enormous amount of movement, if you like, in the policy sector, where there are opportunities for older people and older people's groups to input and have a voice. And I know, again, because I've heard your other podcast, that there is that concern that we're still not hearing older people's voices in terms of self-representation in the way that we would like to do. So I think that's definitely a challenge for the future, particularly given when there are all these openings for voice and for input and so on, and to maximise the good that could come out of those.
I think it's definitely true that there is a lot of good and there's a lot of potential out there. But I'm struck by recent opportunities like that to hear the public voice, and so the underrepresentation of older people's voices on, for example, the Pensions Commission here in Ireland, which ended up publishing a report that said we'll have to, you know, again raise the pension age, not really backing that argument up with solid economic data as they said they were. But it just seems that the theory is great and we espouse great things and we say this is going to happen, but in practice we're still falling short on a lot of in a lot of areas on older people advocating for themselves by themselves.
I think what I would say is that it's good that at least we're agreed it should happen, and I think there is that agreement, and I think that there are mechanisms through say Age Friendly Ireland, and I know some of the other organisations like Active Retirement, you have your mechanisms for hearing for your members and so on. I suppose I'd have a sense that maybe there are times when there's a bigger voice that's needed that goes beyond all of the, you know, the membership networks, if you like. At say moments like the pandemic was one example, but there will be others coming through in the future. And there's that question just of how you build capacity for participation and engagement at different levels. So there's the level where, you know, people come out on the street and they have their placards. It's a moment. And that's, you know, so that's organised and people participate. There's the level of a consultation. And I know there would be concerns sometimes that consultations are tick box exercises.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want just that. I mean, but there's a whole other level, which is about empowerment, where people are, and older people themselves are running, you know, a particular show, whatever that show is themselves. And there's also, I think, with some of the policy material that's going on, there's also sort of space for working with older people's groups to build technical capacity in particular areas, say in relation to pensions and all of that. That's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. Not everybody wants to do it, but there will always be some who do. And it's so I think there's probably around education, training, capacity building, there's maybe a need to think across a spectrum of participation and a spectrum of kind of support that's needed to build capacity at those different levels.
I think that's something that's been it's been voiced, you know, older people's organisations have said it here, and time and again I think it comes to that when there's pressure on resources, when we as a nation, when any nation, any organisation, any structure is put to the pin of their collar, something has to go. And usually it's that nice fluffy stuff like you know, lifelong learning for older people. We saw during the last recession that was absolutely snipped right around the country because the priority was get people back into work. And then all of a sudden, in after decades of improvement, gradual and slow improvement, and realizing that older people have a right and an entitlement and that they get great benefits from lifelong learning, that self-awareness, self-evaluation, self-fulfillment, and that capacity building on a very personal level. And that's just snipped. It's gone because we need to invest money through, we look at it through an economic lens, and we look for people who can contribute, you know, I'm doing the air quotes, which
yes.
and we're not on a visual medium. We look for people who can, you know, supposedly contribute to society. Society in this case being an economic society. So would you be hopeful that it's being heard, that we are realizing that there's more to life than just that economic lens?
Absolutely. And what I would say, I think you're touching on something, excuse me, really important there, in the sense that educational attainment, all of the research findings would show that it is really critical in terms of people's quality of life, in terms of their health, in terms of delaying the onset of disability, in terms of life expectancy, life satisfaction, etc. So these are parts of our lives that are not just lived in the workplace between the ages of 20 and 60. Mm. These are parts of our lives that are lived in communities where people go on then to contribute as, whether it's aunts, uncles, grandaunts, grandparents, all of that, but contributing on so many different levels to themselves, to their families and to their communities. So that whole focus on education is, I think, critical. But what I'd really like to see much more seriously addressed is education across the life course and opening up more opportunities for people in later life. So yes, they so adult education opportunities and so on, but where people want to do more structured courses, longer term courses and so on, that becomes part of the offer from our third level institutions and other kinds of bodies as well. So at the moment, we've got as far as I understand it of thinking about putting pension and work life together. So at least we're saying now, in terms of the discussion, well, we shouldn't be setting a pension age and having a different age in employment contracts, which is what can happen at the minute.
Yeah.
So that's two parts, or two legs of the stool, if you like. But the third leg must be education and training, and not just for the workplace, but for one's life.
Yeah.
And for one's relationships and one's engagement. And if we see what's going on globally in terms of, you know, the climate crisis, in terms of all of these other major issues, COVID and so on, there's technical ability required in terms of responding to those crises, but there's also interpersonal skills, abilities, building relationships, building trust at all kinds of different levels between institutions. You can't run your world, whatever level your world is at, unless you can manage your relationships, and education is part of that.
It's huge. We had Professor Roseanne Kenny from the Tilda Project on the podcast, and she underscored the importance of educational attainment just on the outcomes to your own personal life. Like, the higher you have or the longer you've stayed in education, the more likely it is that you live longer, happier, healthier and so on. And it's one thing to look at that and say, oh, great, well, we've got to try and keep people in school for longer. But it's quite another thing, and maybe a leap that we're starting to take, but we're not fully taking yet, that we look at, well, education doesn't end at 19 or 20 or 22 or 30 if you stick around and do a PhD or whatever it might be. That education goes on, and it happens in so many different settings, formal and informal. There are formal things. It's great. DCU is an age-friendly university. Mm. A lot of the universities are looking that way. Mm. I mean, the cynic in me might say that they see there's an opportunity to, you know, take in lucrative postgraduate applications from all walks of life. But it's still quite good. It's still quite a good thing that they're looking that way. But informal education and community education is also quite important to that overall picture of sort of building up your own toolkit and you know, that level of self-fulfillment that helps you with that relationship building that you were talking about.
Absolutely. But and I also, having said all of that, I'm going to go back, just this is an anecdote from my own earlier work experience, where actually I was doing some work with people who had returned as adults, older adults actually, through workplace opportunities, to acquiring literacy skills, learning how to read, write and do their numbers and their maths and so on. And these were adults who had hidden the problem, you know, from childhood. And that the memory of that and what it meant to people to actually acquire literacy skills, to be able to help with homework and all of that, will always be with me. And there were so many individual interviews. It was a little piece of evaluation at the time. But the phrase that was used over and over again was education is no load. It's no load to carry. And I think that's just really important. And particularly those of us who have parents who maybe had to leave school early. That was the way it was at that time and so on.
Yeah, I think it's really, really nice. Education is no load. It's not a burden at any stage of the life course. So if we want to build the capacity of older people, or if we as a nation, even if older people as a, and again, not to homogenize, but as a cohort, want to build that capacity and build those relationships and create those networks and, you know, just basically make life better for themselves, advocacy is a huge part of that. Being able to speak out, and self-advocacy in particular, being able to speak out. I mean, you've worked for a very long time in advocacy for older people, working with organizations like, obviously we know each other because Active Retirement was part of Older and Bolder. That was 5 years campaigning, more,
longer? It was 5 years campaigning, and it closed in 2013. So that's quite a while ago now. Yeah.
And there isn't a similar umbrella organisation. There are NGOs working together. There's the Alliance of Age-Related NGOs. There are organisations that come together. There hasn't really been a similar unifying campaign with an end goal in mind, like the National Positive Ageing Strategy or anything like that. Do you think it's something that's lacking from the Irish picture?
Well, yes, I think, honestly, I do think it is. What I would say is it's excellent to see the alliance of age organisations coming together. And I was really pleased. I did look at the budget submission, and there was a call, I think, for a champion to advance the National Positive Ageing Strategy and implementation of in a holistic way and so on as part of the submission. And I thought that was, you know, well pitched and so on. I think that there's the need for the organisations to be able to maybe mobilise their resources, but at particular times and moments. So that would be coming together with that in mind, and maybe having the kind of preparation done so that they, you know, they're on standby. It's a bit like doing your good policy work. You have your position on the pension or whatever it is. You don't need it just now, but then something happens politically and that's your moment. And that's when you go live in terms of all your public discussion and debate. So I think there's that capacity to mobilise. But I also have this sense that outside, if you like, the policy world and the legal world where people are engaged with each other, there's probably a larger number of older people who don't necessarily want to sign up for organisation membership, but maybe want to tune in for particular moments or particular opportunities. And there needs to be some way of, communicating with them and mobilising or bringing to inform, because there's no point in being involved in any policy discussion unless you're informed. And indeed, I was listening to your podcast on digital inclusion. So I thought, well, that's a really practical way in which, you know, you can bring more people into the tent, if you like. They may not want to be there all the time, but if you can pull them in and pull them out. And also there's the whole thing of the scope for peer training, so that you have peer leaders who are going to provide that kind of training and that kind of support and help people to build up capacity.
Well, there's an old adage, and we've said it on the podcast before, and it's so true. And I see it in so many walks of life, and it makes so much sense to me every time I hear it. If you can't see it, you can't be it. So if we don't empower older people to advocate for themselves, if we don't have some kind of cohesive strategy to enrich the lives of older people so that they can see other older people basically fight their corner, we're on a hiding to nothing, really. It's not a fight we're going to win.
I think the other thing is here I'm going back to, you know, remembering myself as a very young woman and learning about feminism and so on for the first time, and how important it was at that point to come together with other women and to actually begin to share experience, to realise, oh, what's happening to me isn't happening to me as an individual. It's actually, there's a pattern here, and the shared experience across a group for a particular set of reasons. So my point is that there's a merit for older people in coming together, looking at maybe their experiences around ages, and might be a way in for for example, particularly in the context of the UN decade. And so there's individual experiences and people beginning to identify patterns and then beginning to sort of, you know, understand and to sort of analyse, well, where might the entry points be to do something about this. Now, the other thing I would go on to say, though, you know, I agree that it's really important that we are consulting with older people, and that older people ultimately are in the driving seat themselves. That's the goal, if you will. But I suppose the other sort of question I have, and this is one now that people would debate probably, is ultimately, I think, aren't we more interested in a movement for progressive change? So therefore, it's equality for everyone. So if we have one group just being louder and just being more successful in its advocacy than another group, well, what's changing really? Mm. Whereas if we have some, you know, core principles and values that we sort of share in terms of a progressive movement for change, and we can ensure that older people are strong within that and have spaces of their own within it, but that others are engaged cross-sectorally in the way that we were speaking about at the very beginning, wouldn't that be the way to go? And even when we're thinking about principles and values, I know that one of the things that was helpful to us in HelpAge when we were looking at public health guidance, and people had very different views in relation to it, one of our colleagues looked at human rights principles and did some workshops on that, as using the principles, the human rights principles, as a way to sort of decide, well, are we happy with this public health guidance or not? Mm. And I'm just sort of suggesting those kinds of principles might also be helpful to us in terms of thinking about, you know, how we work together and, you know, how we bring older people together, but how in turn we ensure older people are linked in with other groups and other self-advocates.
So it's as you say, it's that intersectionality. It's trying to look at everything through an equality lens. And I love that idea, building a progressive movement for change. I think it's fantastic. You've radicalized me here. I don't think there was much radicalization needed, to be honest with you. I think it speaks to a lot of us. It speaks to me. It speaks to a lot of people who'd be listening. So finally, before we finish up, what are your hopes for the UN decade of healthy aging? What do you hope to see develop over the course of a 10-year period? It's phenomenal, really, the scope and the breadth of what is possible. But I mean, with a tinge of realism, what do you hope to see?
I think at the community level and at the national level, I would really like to hear conversations about ageism buzzing around me, awareness about ageism buzzing around all of us, and just another level of awareness in relation to our media, in relation to our education systems, in relation to how we talk about older people, and the kind of expectations we can have for ourselves and about our older relatives and older peers as we get older, so that there's a much greater just awareness about actually how ageism can be damaging individually and also at the level of institutions when we aren't funding services and so on adequately for older people. So much more awareness and then moving into some practical action in terms of the systems that keep ageism going. Mm. So that's one thing that I would really want to see. Obviously, I'd like to see it here in Ireland, but I know it's going to happen globally as well. There's no doubt about that. And that we'll have the kind of shifts that seemed unthinkable in relation to women and in relation to people of colour and in relation to people of other identities, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. We'll have that in relation to older people, and we'll have sort of that greater equality. So this is me dreaming.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, I think it's realistic dreams.
Okay. And then very practically, on the global level, I think that the UN agencies actually being tuned in around ageing and giving more leadership on ageing and on older people. So at the moment, what we have internationally is the Madrid International Plan of Action on Ageing. It was a breakthrough in its time, but it's not enough. And the call now is for a UN Convention on the Rights of Older Persons. That's what I would like to see, and older people swinging in behind that at all levels. And I think if we get the movement on ages, and we'll get more action in terms of the convention, but also that kind of putting older people much more to the centre of UN agencies' work, because they in turn influence the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, all of these international and then regional bodies begin to speak that language. So, and maybe I hope I don't complicate it too much, but the decade is happening alongside Agenda 2030 and the Sustainable Development Goals. That's deliberate. Mm. And the Agenda 2030 is about eradicating poverty and promoting equality for everyone. So you would hope at the moment older people are not getting the attention they need within Agenda 2030.
Within Agenda or within the Sustainable Development
Goals.
No,
they're not. Yeah. No, they're absolutely not. And therefore, I would hope as well that there would be this sort of interflow between the decade and the Agenda 2030 so we have better practical outcomes in terms of the SDGs for older people.
It makes a whole lot of sense. It's right back to intersectionality. It's right back to coming together, working together to build a progressive movement for change. That's the hope. That's the goal. I share your hopes. I hope we can see it. I hope it's a good 10 years for making progressive strides for older people, for everyone. Patricia Conboy, Adjunct Lecturer with the Irish Centre for Social Gerontology in NUI Galway, policy expert, consultant, friend. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. Thanks a million.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Peter. I loved having the conversation with you.
The Old Country is recorded in the podcast studios, McGuinness Place, Dublin 2. For more information, check out thepodcaststudios.ie. This podcast is brought to you by Active Retirement Ireland as part of the UN Decade of Healthy Ageing. This podcast is supported by the Community Foundation for Ireland, and thanks, as always, to our media partners, Alice PR.